Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Whether the story of Gottfried Plattner is to be credited or not is a pretty question in the value of evidence. On the one hand, we have 7 witnesses. To be perfectly exact, we have 6.5 pairs of eyes and 1 undeniable fact. And on the other, we have... what is it? Prejudice? Common sense? The inertia of opinion? Never were there 7 more honest-seeming witnesses. Never was there a more undeniable fact than the inversion of Gottfried Plattner's anatomical structure. And never was there a more preposterous story than the one they have to tell. The most preposterous part of the story is the worthy Gottfried's contribution, for I count him as 1 of the 7. Frankly, I believe there's something crooked about this business of Gottfried Plattner. But what that crooked factor is, I will admit as frankly, I do not know. I've been surprised at the credit accorded to the story in the most unexpected and authoritative quarters. The fairest way to the reader, however, will be for me to tell it without further comment.
A lot of information in that opening. The inversion of Gottfried Plattner's anatomical structure is the important bit, I suppose, but I was really distracted by the reference to 7 witnesses with 6.5 pairs of eyes. Is somebody in the story going to have an eye patch?
That's what I thought.
Or will one person be blind while another hides a third eye in her forehead under a fancy hat?
Wow. They could be the eyes of a leopardess.
As the saying goes, the eyes have it. And they've got it bad here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. This week we're covering The Plattner Story by H.G. Wells.
Right away, that title tells you this story is going to be hella average. I believe that's the literary term. Why not The Backwards Man or The Inverted Man or Journey to the Fourth Dimension? Not to say that the concept in the story isn't really cool. It is Wells after all. Mm-hmm. And that opening text was certainly helped along by an awesome reader. Who the heck was that?
Today's reader is none other than Eric Peabody of Viking Guitar Productions. Mixing, mastering, voiceover, and podcast support, he's the 3rd member of our team here on the show. And the strongest. We haven't actually tested that out, but he mentions it a lot, and he's probably right.
Every email he says, by the way, I'm stronger than you guys. I don't know where it comes from, but I accept it as truth. Yeah. Eric actually stepped in last minute for this, and we're so grateful.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for helping us out.
Please check out Eric's readings on the Horror Hill podcast. This month, he is doing Hounds of Tindolus and my story, Snack Time.
That's right.
Go check it out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes.
That was your story from the Shotguns versus Cthulhu anthology, if I'm correct.
That's right, yes.
Now it's got the full read treatment, which is fantastic, and I hope everybody will go check that out at Horror Hill.
The Plattner story was first published in the April 1896 issue of the New Review. Our story begins with an unnamed narrator telling us about this guy, Gottfried Plattner. I normally love me some H.G. Wells, but it really felt like he was getting paid by the word on the story. I think it's supposed to be the character of the narrator who meanders in his telling, but it just really bugged me.
I agree. Kind of had a harder time getting through this one. It follows the Wellsian structure, which we've talked about or discovered a bit when we covered his other stuff. The Invisible Man and Dr. Moreau have almost scientific story organization. Mm-hmm. In the first half, you see all of the symptoms of the strange occurrence.
Yeah.
But you can't understand what's going on. Why is that man all bandaged up and also part pig? At the midpoint, a back narrative begins to fill all of this in. Yeah. And we discover the story behind how these things happened. It's something that, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson also did in Jekyll and Hyde. Once you're caught up, you drive to some sort of action-packed finale. I felt like this story was hung on that same hanger as those stories, but there was a lot of padding.
Mm.
Those other books are normal blouses. This one has really big shoulder pads. I think I'm trying to use the literary terms on this episode. That's the way to think of it. But the character, Gottfried Plattner, his father was Alsatian, an Alsatian immigrant to England. Alsace is a cultural region that's both French and German.
Mm.
So Gottfried, born an Englishman, but grew up hearing those other languages and therefore became a language teacher because he was exposed to all those languages in the household.
He is also noticeably unsymmetrical. And honestly, most people are unsymmetrical. And I remember originally, way back when, being weirded out seeing myself in videos or in pictures because you don't look quite right. Because we're used to looking at ourselves in mirrors. So the real us is inverted from what we're used to looking at. But I feel like with smartphones and stuff and social media and people are always taking pictures of themselves, that that's not really a thing anymore.
Right. You now see the correct orientation that other people are seeing.
Yeah.
But this character, Gottfried Plattner, he's got that mirror image thing.
Yeah.
I think it was his right eye was a little larger than the left, his jaw a little heavier on the right side, and that's been flipped. And so that's really odd. On our Wabi Sabi Extra Credit episode, you know, we talked a bit about design, how there are rules, and then typically you break one rule. And I feel like when we talk about beautiful people in culture, they often have that. They have perfectly symmetrical features, but then there'll be one odd thing.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be like the formula for most celebrities.
Yeah.
Everything's perfect. But one little thing one that little makes thing you makes go, oh, they're just like me.
Stand out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Being unsymmetrical, it's no big whoop, but Gottfried is backwards in a few ways. One, his heart is on the right side of his chest, not the left. His liver is also reversed. He's left-handed now, but he wasn't before. There was an incident that the narrator is dancing around. Something happened to Gottfried that reversed him into a mirror image of himself. Old photos show that his body was indeed flipped. So there's evidence to show that he didn't used to look that way, but he does now.
Right.
So that's not in question. But how and why is what this tale is going to explore.
A pretty kooky mystery to begin with. It was a good hook for me. That's why I wanted to cover this. This guy Plattner doesn't seem like the type to manufacture evidence like the photos. Even in those days, you probably could have done something to make it a mirror image.
Sure.
But he's suddenly, like you said, he's doing everything left-handed as well. That's all the evidence I need because I'm actually already left-handed, but when I try to write with my right hand, it is truly embarrassing what comes out on that paper. Doesn't it make you feel like, I don't know, so limited? Can you write with both hands or draw with both hands?
Me? No, God, no. Jeez.
Yeah.
Not at all. It's a mess. It's terrible. Don't even think about it. This flip, he hasn't bragged about this. This isn't something he's proud of. He doesn't tell anybody about it. It's private. And he's quite ashamed of the whole thing.
He doesn't want the attention. It's important that we understand he's a normal guy, underwhelming, not a showman. This is no Spirit Fakers of Hermannstadt, folks.
According to the narrator, science tells us that the only way that we can flip like this is for the person to be totally removed from space.
To put the thing in technical language, the story says, the curious inversion of Plattner's right and left sides is proof that he has moved out of our space into what is called the fourth dimension, and that he has returned again to our world. There's, as it says, there's no way to have done this flip in space to a three-dimensional body. A thin and flat thing, yes. It says if you were to cut a figure out of paper, any figure with a right and left side, you could change its side simply by lifting it up and turning it over. So somehow, Plattner exited to a different dimension where this flipping occurred and re-entered our three-dimensional space.
There's an essay written in 1880 called What is the Fourth Dimension by Charles Howard Hinton, and he came up with that image of the four-dimensional cube, also called a tesseract, that you've seen multiple times. It's like a cube within a cube, and there's lines from the corners of the cubes coming inside of it.
Yeah, I became aware of this concept in junior high from the book A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes, exactly. Now, later, Einstein would use the fourth dimension in his theory of relativity, but it doesn't mean the same thing as it did to Hinton, exactly. Mm-hmm. Modern physics has the fourth dimension meaning space-time. This predates space-time by quite a few years. Since the story was written in the late 19th century, it has some outdated scientific ideas, but it's still cool.
I started reading the essay, What is the Fourth Dimension? We can link out to it, but it was complicated.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to get back into it after we're done. But I guess I'm just afraid that if I read it all and I do comprehend it, will I disappear then?
You might.
Big risk.
We get to the actual incident. Gottfried is teaching chemistry at the Sussexville Proprietary School. His specialty, we said at the top, language, but he's stuck teaching something he doesn't actually know anything about.
This setup was my favorite part of the story. The chemistry teacher who's completely winging it. History, English, you can coach those by just having the kids do some reading and some discussing, but science or math, that's a real problem if you're not trained in those disciplines. It says, in chemistry, he was particularly deficient, knowing, he says, nothing beyond the three gases, whatever the three gases may be. So all he knows is there's three of them, whatever they are. As, however, his pupils began by knowing nothing and derived all their information from him, this caused him, or anyone, but little inconvenience for several terms.
Yeah.
So just the idea that Gottfried, he had all that time to put out bad information.
Oof.
It was so entertaining to me. Maybe a little scary, because that probably does happen. But if he was making up chemistry lessons every day for a year, what kind of nonsense are these kids carrying around in their minds? Because it's not like they come home and tell other folks what they learned. No. They just learn it internalize it.
There's this kid in his class, Wibble, who's very inquisitive and excited about science. One day, he brings in a mysterious green powder that he found in a packet in an old lime kiln. Wibble brings this stuff in a small medicine bottle to the classroom. After school, Godfrey Plattner decides that he's going to try and figure out what this stuff is.
Figure out. I mean, so this kid has brought other samples of things before, and Plattner has also tested them, which sounds a lot like the tests I did on things with my chemistry set when I was a kid. I didn't look at the book. I just poured things on other things to see if anything happened, which is the kind of testing that Plattner is doing here because he's basically hosting detention right now and just wants to do something. So he's going to pretend that he's the expert and can somehow figure out what this kid brought in, what it is. But he has no idea.
After this testing, he decides that he's going to put a match to some of it. While he does this, he is holding what was left of this stuff in the bottle in his hand. As he lights it, it explodes in this blinding flash. The students come in to investigate. The window's blown out. The blackboard is askew. Gottfried is nowhere to be found. Also, one of the teachers, Mr. Lidget, enters, and he tries to figure out what's happened to Godfrey.
Now, it's important that he had the bottle in the other hand, because I think it even says he slipped it into his pocket. Thank goodness.
Yes.
Or else I don't think he would be coming back, because it was this substance, obviously, that he lit that threw him into another dimension. Mr. Lidget, when he comes in, we find out he is a corpulent, excitable man with one eye. Aha! Solves the mystery. That's why it's 6.5 pairs of eyes.
Most people were sure that Gottfried was in the room when it exploded, therefore theorized that he was vaporized.
Yeah, but Lidget pushes hard to minimize the whole thing in town. He plays up that they're not sure exactly what happened. I thought it was funny. He doesn't want to injure the reputation of the school. So he's saying this is an ordinary accident. No big deal. I mean, the whole room didn't explode. It was just the front of it where he was.
Yes.
So the only evidence is what the eyewitnesses say he was there and he wasn't. So they can't prove that he didn't just do a magic trick and then run away. There is a possibility of an Ichabod Crane scenario, you know?
After this explosion, it's reported at school and in town that people were dreaming about or thinking about Gottfried. Strangely, they were also seeing the same thing. His face was pale. He was in some kind of distress. He would come at the person and look deeply into their eyes. That is, if they didn't run off in fear. Some also thought that they might have seen some kind of globular creature with Gottfried.
Whoa.
It's crazy stuff. 9 days later, Gottfried returns.
Mr. Lidget is in his garden at home on a Wednesday evening, picking and eating strawberries, which he loves. And bam, something hits him just as he's bending over to pick a strawberry. He falls and, looking up, sees that the thing that hit him was Gottfried.
Yeah.
He was collarless and hatless. His linen was dirty and there was blood upon his hands.
No one noticed his left and his right sides were flipped, at least for the first few days. And he tried to hide that he was now left-handed, so he had trouble riding, obviously.
He's happy enough to be home that he doesn't try and get any other attention for what might have happened to him. That's the mystery. After an explosion in the chemistry lab, this teacher disappeared. People dreamed of him drifting around with some orb or orbs. And 9 days later, he popped back into existence, although a mirror image of his former self. So we actually are at that midpoint. Now Wells will expose himself. Expose the mystery, rather. Of what's behind all of this.
Yes. Gottfried Plattner has told the narrator what has happened, and the narrator is going to tell us what happened to Gottfried over those 9 days.
We take you back to the chemistry lab when the explosion happened.
Just as he puts the match to the green powder, an explosion knocks him back. He's able to get up, and he smells singed hair. He sees the boys and Mr. Lidget run into the classroom, but he can't hear them. And he thinks that he might become deafened in that explosion.
They don't seem to notice him at all, though. They're looking around the room, trying to find something.
As he begins to come to his senses, things aren't right. Everything around him seems colorless and gray. But the thing that really freaks him out is that one of the boys walks right through him. He shouts as it happens, but nobody, again, notices him or sees him or hears him. Of course, Gottfried's first thought is he's dead. He's a ghost. But he thinks, well, maybe everybody else is a ghost and I'm alive.
Everything about him was extraordinarily dark. At first, it seemed to have an altogether ebony blackness. Overhead was black firmament. The only touch of light in the scene was a faint greenish glow at the edge of the sky in one direction, which threw into prominence a horizon of undulating black hills. This, I say, was his impression at first. As his eye grew accustomed to the darkness, he began to distinguish a faint quality of differentiating greenish color in the circumambient night.
Against this background, the furniture and occupants of the classroom, it seems, stood out like phosphorescent specters, faint and impalpable. He extended his hand and thrust it without an effort through the wall of the room by the fireplace. He describes himself as making a strenuous effort to attract attention. He shouted to Lidget and tried to seize the boys as they went to and fro. He only desisted from these attempts when Mrs. Lidget, whom he, as an assistant master, naturally disliked, entered the room. He says the sensation of being in the world, and yet not a part of it, was an extraordinarily disagreeable one. He compared his feelings, not inaptly, to those of a cat watching a mouse through a window. Whenever he made a motion to communicate with the dim, familiar world around him, he found an invisible, incomprehensible barrier preventing intercourse.
Dandolo.
Dandolo! Look at that! H.G. Wells, pioneer of the Dandolo experience. He compared his feelings to those of a cat watching a mouse through a window. That's what Dandolo's going through.
You're right.
Dandolo, for those who don't remember the running joke, is the cat from The Fly who was broken down into atoms in one transporter machine but didn't make it to the other, and so is doomed to meow throughout the air eternally. We thought that the separated Dandolo molecules were, you know, those molecules being able to meow was preposterous, you and I. We thought that was stupid, but maybe this is what happened. The cat's in the fourth dimension. That was the error. It's trying to communicate with us. Thank you, H.G. Wells. You solved it. No more Dandolo. That's it. Sorry, guys.
H.G. Wells is so awesome that he's solving problems and he's been dead for like 100 years. In this place that Gottfried finds himself, the only thing that's solid for him is the bottle of green powder, which he still holds in his hand. He puts it in his pocket.
Oh, that's where he puts it in his pocket. Okay.
Gottfried feels around and he thinks he's on some kind of boulder with moss growing over it, but it's dark and he can't see very well. Gottfried walks towards that green glow of the skyline where it seems to be brighter, and he notices that the world is totally quiet, and he thinks that he sees some black shapes flutter in the distance. As the green light brightens, he hears the ring of a bell.
It's a pretty weird landscape that wouldn't be out of place in a Lovecraft story. Last month, I said we wouldn't have reason to bring Lovecraft up in our science fiction month, but there you go.
Yeah.
Speaking of other authors, this fourth dimension concept also came up when we covered Oscar Wilde's The Canterbury Ghost.
Oh.
Also, you know, lately I've been enjoying the work of Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov, which was his last work completed in 1880, which would have been just a few years before this story. The fourth dimension is used to signify that which is ungraspable to someone with earthly or three-dimensional concerns. In the book, Ivan Karamazov laments to his younger brother, "I have a Euclidean earthly mind, and how could I solve problems that are not of this world? And I advise you never to think about it either, about God, whether he exists or not. All such questions are utterly inappropriate for a mind created with an idea of only three dimensions." The fourth dimension, in both a scientific and literary sense, is the world that's all around us, which we cannot perceive. Obviously also explored in From Beyond.
Yeah.
And Plattner has slipped into this dimension, although he can still see the normal world. Plattner, by his few steps downhill, had passed through the floor of the classroom and was now, it seemed, sitting in midair in the larger schoolroom downstairs.
A large green object appears in the sky, lighting up everything.
And almost immediately, the limb of a huge heavenly body of blazing green rose over the basaltic undulations of the distant hills, and the monstrous hill masses about him came out gaunt and desolate, in green light and deep, ruddy black shadows.
Gottfried sees these ball-shaped objects drifting over the land. The bell is ringing quicker and quicker. This is just some nutty stuff going on here.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, I had a real hard time understanding what was going on. I had to reread this over and over again because it's so detached from reality. It's daytime in this place, or what you would call daytime, when this green light is shining, and he can see physical structures in this world, but he can't see those ghostly images of the real world. At night, he can see that stuff. They say something about it being how something is phosphorescent in bright light. You can't see it, but when it's dark, you can see it. And that's how it is here.
A bit of a bizarro world thing happening. When it's daytime in the real world, you can't see anything in this world. But when it's dark in the real world, then you can suddenly see it because of that phosphorescence. In fact, when he talks about that, I thought it was an interesting little bit of interactive storytelling that Wells was doing. It says, Plattner describes the midday of the other world at its brightest as not being nearly so bright as this world at full moon, while its night is profoundly black. Consequently, the amount of light even in an ordinary dark room, is sufficient to render the things of the other world invisible, on the same principle that faint phosphorescence is only visible in the profoundest darkness. I have tried, since he told me his story, to see something of the other world by sitting for a long space in a photographer's dark room at night. I have certainly seen indistinctly the form of greenish slopes and rocks, but only, I must admit, very indistinctly indeed. The reader may possibly be more successful. So he's throwing down a challenge.
Wow, okay, I gotta
go
do that.
Confuse your entire family by going and sitting in a dark room at night for very long periods of time. I'm trying to see the green hills of the other world. Leave me alone.
When the green sun comes up, Gottfried can see these black buildings in the valley, and he decides to investigate. When he gets down there, the buildings seem like tombs or mausoleums, and they're black instead of white.
Then he saw, crowding out of the largest building, very much as people disperse from church, a number of pallid, rounded, pale green figures. These dispersed in several directions around the broad street of the place, some going through side alleys and reappearing upon the steepness of the hill, others entering some of the black, small buildings which lined the way.
They get closer to him, and when they do, he can see that they have no limbs. They're heads with tadpole-like bodies that swing under them. As they get closer, he can see that they have expressions of anguish and distress on their faces.
I just kept thinking about the Madballs. Those toys from the 80s. Yeah, do you remember those?
Yes, I do.
They were little foam balls that had faces sculpted into them.
Yeah. And they were very creepy looking and had lots of like, kind of faces. And you know?
That is the best description possible. They were part of that like gross out thing that was really trendy at the time when Cabbage Patch Kids were being parodied by the Garbage Pail Kids.
Right.
And everything was about how gross they were and it was that kind of thing. But I loved Madballs. I even got the comic books of the Madballs. That's how much I liked them. And this is H.G. Wells predicting that as well, I guess.
Wow. He's a futurist. These head ghosts don't notice Gottfried at all and are focused on something that he can't see. And it occurs to him that they are watching something in our world. A floating head ghost bumps into Gottfried, but it doesn't seem bothered by him, and it feels cold to the touch. These things are tangible. Looking at the head, it resembles Lidget, which is bizarre. More floating heads come by, and some of them aren't just anguished. Some are really angry, while others are weeping. They move out and around during the green day. As the sun sets, the tadpole heads creep back to their mausoleums, and Platner finds some rocks to sleep on during the day.
These tadpole heads, it's not just Lidget. I think he recognizes a bunch of the other ones, too.
Yeah.
As being students or being parents in the town.
As time passes, he gets hungry and he decides to eat some of this moss and drink some of this water that he's found. Surprisingly, they're both nourishing.
I was a little puzzled by that big rock candy mountain angle. Like, do all the heads come graze here? Why is there stuff to eat?
At night, Gottfried spends some time looking around these tombs, trying to figure what the hell's going on. Inside one is an altar with a green flame and a rope that seems to lead up to a bell. And there's some writing on one of the walls, but it's in no language that he's ever seen before.
It says, round the wall ran a lettering of fire in a character unknown to him. That was really interesting, and it really reminded me of Vandermeer's Annihilation novel, which has a creature writing this flaming language on the walls all the way down this tower.
Oh.
The imagery was very correspondent to this, so I think it must have been an influence.
While he's looking at this temple, he finally hears something, footsteps. He runs out and he tries to follow the sound, but it's dark, so he can't really see anything. He follows the sounds into a gorge, where he spends days wandering around trying to understand what's happening. At nighttime, our world becomes visible in that ghostly way. He would walk the Sussexville streets and be able to see things going on in people's houses, private things. Gottfried also notes that there were always some drifting heads watching people from our world.
Okay, so I'm sure if you checked the Commonplace book, you'd see that somebody told Wells when he was a kid that he better not touch himself because his grandparents were watching and it would make them cry. In the Commonplace book, he goes, what if that were real?
Eventually, Gottfried is noticed by some of the floating heads, and those floating heads resemble his mother and father. He tries to talk with them, but they don't respond.
He knows why. They've seen his shame. You've been in that dark room for a long time.
The narrator speculates a bit on Gottfried's story. What are these things? If they are dead spirits, then why are there ones that represent people that are still alive, like Legend?
Yeah.
And why do they watch people? His entire time there, Gottfried just tries to understand what's going on, and he feels himself slipping away, getting hungrier and more tired, and the whole thing's just messed up. It's distressing, and it's got to be insanity-inducing.
Of course! I mean, I think I might throw more of an effort into trying to haunt people, at least as a distraction for a while.
That would
be
fun.
This is, yeah, I'd go insane pretty quickly.
On the ninth day, Gottfried is following the steps around, which lead him to a room near the school. Inside are people he's seen before. One man on a bed. He's looking like he's in trouble. There's some medicine bottles on the stand by the bed, and there's a woman. Also, more floating heads are here in this place than he's ever seen together at any time before. And they seem very focused on this man in the bed.
Yes. Now, this is the part of the well structure where he kind of rushes to the end after you've found out what caused the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
This story is rare, though, because there really isn't a good explanation for what this world is. So it's a mystery behind a mystery. One explains the other, but neither, you know, the second mystery is inexplicable. But he's got to get to the end, so he introduces a whole other plot here with people who are somewhat unknown to the narrator in another home. And I'm going to go ahead and spoil it. It looks like a man is dying and his treacherous young wife or new wife is destroying the will that he may have filled out later so that she can get everything that belongs to him.
Yeah.
That's what's being witnessed here.
She's looking through some papers. The bell rings and the faces begin to sway and cry. The woman finds something. Maybe it's this will. She lights it on fire with a candle.
At the second stroke, everything grew dim, and a breath of wind, icy cold, blew through the host of watchers. They swirled about him like an eddy of dead leaves in the spring, and at the third stroke, something was extended through them to the bed. You have heard of a beam of light. This was like a beam of darkness, and looking at it again, Plattner saw that it was a shadowy arm and hand.
So I believe death is making an appearance.
The arm reaches out to the man in the bed and the man convulses.
Then suddenly, Plattner understood the meaning of the shadowy black arm that stretched across his shoulder and clutched its prey. He did not dare turn his head to see the shadow behind the arm. With a violent effort and covering his eyes, he set himself to run, made perhaps 20 strides, then slipped on a boulder and fell. He fell forward on his hands, and the bottle smashed and exploded as he touched the ground.
Gottfried finds himself stunned and bleeding in the walled garden face to face with Lidget. We go back to the narrator. He insists that this story is as Plattner told it, and he didn't expound on anything, and we end with this.
It remains to add that a death did actually occur in Vincent Terrace, just beyond the school garden, and, so far as can be proved, at the moment of Plattner's return. Deceased was a rate collector and insurance agent. His widow, who was much younger than himself, married last month a Mr. Whimper, a veterinary surgeon. As the portion of this story given here has in various forms circulated orally in Sussexville, she has consented to my use of her name, on condition that I make it distinctly known that she emphatically contradicts every detail of Plattner's account of her husband's last moments. She burnt no will, she says, although Plattner never accused her of doing so. Her husband made but one will, and that just after their marriage. Certainly, from a man who had never seen it, Plattner's account of the furniture of the room was curiously accurate. One other thing, even at the risk of an irksome repetition, I must insist on, lest I seem to favor the credulous, superstitious view. Plattner's absence from the world for 9 days is, I think, proved. But that does not prove his story. It is quite conceivable that even outside space, hallucinations may be possible. That, at least, the reader must bear distinctly in mind.
And that's the end.
That's it?
So I'm not saying it happened, but it probably happened. I said that this was no Spirit Fakers of Hermannstadt, but wait a minute, I was wrong. There's a morally compromised Harris.
All right.
Maybe she was burning some kind of testimony of her late Draculized father who was a serial killer.
That makes sense.
And it wasn't a will. I don't know.
That makes sense to me.
Either way, bad news. So what did you think? You didn't particularly care for the story.
I didn't care for it because Wells is such a great writer normally and is so succinct and to the point and you just get hooked up in it. This was the opposite experience for me. I just had to keep reading it over and over again, and it meanders, and he repeats things paragraph after paragraph, and I'm like, what is going on with this? It seems like, again, he was getting paid by the word, and just needed a paycheck, and he's probably coasting on his other work, and that's how it feels to me.
Yeah, or I don't know if he was paid by the word, or at least the pressures of the publication weren't as they were for his other books, so he didn't feel as compelled to make it action-packed, you know, like Moreau was.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was a little underwhelmed by it as well, although I'm always glad to see how these concepts get explored.
Cool ideas. It's a really neat idea. Really crazy, very cosmic horror, Lovecraftian nuttiness in here that doesn't really get explained. Like, what the hell is going on with all this stuff?
And also introducing the whole genre of something's in another dimension or passing between dimensions, which seems to be a form of mainstream plot entertainment right now.
Yeah,
tons of movies about people skipping over to other dimensions where things aren't the same or a little bit different. Edgar Allan Poe actually wrote an essay on cosmology titled Eureka back in 1848, which said, quote, space and duration are one. This is the first known instance of suggesting space and time to be different perceptions of one thing. Which is pretty crazy that Poe also came up with that, as well as the detective story. Poe arrived at this conclusion after approximately 90 pages of reasoning, but employed no mathematics.
Wow.
But was out there talking about the space-time continuum.
That's crazy.
Arthur C. Clarke published the 1950 short story Technical Error, which explored the effects on a man after he had been rotated in the fourth dimension.
Huh.
This exact kind of plot explored by Arthur C. Clarke might be a little bit more of a satisfying story, maybe, in his hands.
Yeah.
And, of course, in Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, recurring character Kilgore Trout writes a book called Maniacs in the Fourth Dimension, which relates how three-dimensional Earthling doctors were unable to cure people with mental diseases as the causes were all in the fourth dimension. Trout explains how vampires and werewolves and goblins and angels reside in this alternative plane alongside poet William Blake. So lots of folks have played with this concept that Wells is introducing here and that was introduced in some works at the time that he was reading.
Our reader was once again Eric Peabody.
Please check out Eric's readings for the Horror Hill podcast, especially The Hounds of Tyndalus and the story Snack Time by our very own Chris Lackey.
Yeah.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Eric.
We're going to link out in the show notes, and I also want to thank some of our patrons.
I'd like to thank Donnie Knowles.
Curtis, thank you so much.
Joaquin Nyback, thank you.
Paul Urfey, thank you so much.
Steve Ellis, thank you.
Anthony Pryor, thank you.
Hey, I'd like to thank Chad Welsh.
Wizard Thing, thank you.
Daniel Mather, thank you so much.
And Carol D, thank you. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and this has been Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.